and decades of Cuban-American relations are changing on a dime. Luis shakes his head in resignation. If you'd like, we can hit up the major sites today and see where we end up. My grandmother will be here when we return. This article you're writing, what kind of tips are you looking for? The article has been the last thing on my mind since Anna handed me that box. A mix, really. Tourist spots, things that are off the beaten path. I can see him turning over the expression in his mind. There's that look again, as though I've amused him. I can't tell if Luis Rodriguez likes me or is vaguely appalled. We could start with the malecón, he says. It's better at night if you want the full effect, though. That's when everyone comes out. By day it's not much to see. The Malecón. 5 miles of seawall and promenade separating Havana from the Caribbean Sea. Has been on the top of my must-see list after hearing about it from my grandmother. It was one of her favorite places in Havana. I used to stand at the edge of the water and look out at the ocean. You could see all manner of things when you stared into that wide expanse of blue, Marisol. The world felt limitless, as though it was ours for the taking. After reading the letters and learning what the Malecón meant to her and her lover, about their first date there, I now understand a bit more why the spot was so dear to her. Do you have a list of places where you're considering spreading your grandmother's ashes? Luis asks. We could tackle those first if you'd like, then do more tourist sites. I'm still working on that. I hoped I'd get a feel for the city. I thought something might speak to me. I expect amusement in his gaze, but he simply nods as though he understands, as if family means as much to him as it does to me. Well, why don't you let me play tour guide, and if there's anything you want to see along the way, we can take a detour? Luis suggests. He holds his hand out to me, and I know he's only being polite, but my nerves reappear. The tension in my body returning with a vengeance. I give him my hand, our palms connecting, our fingers threading together, and a new kind of energy, excitement and anticipation, enters my body as he leads me down the cracked steps and onto the sidewalk, into the vintage Buick, and out into Havana. Chapter 10 We leave Miramar and drive to Old Havana, the part of the city that's most frequently seen in tourist photographs and iconic images. Here the buildings have retained much of their original state, the architecture harkening back to a time when Spanish influence played a defining role in the island's development, when Cuba was a jewel in Spain's imperial crown. Many of the buildings are in a state of disrepair, but others have been lovingly, painstakingly restored. And it's clear why tourists name this as one of the top sites to see in Havana. In the 80s, this neighborhood was designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, Luis explains. There's a movement in place to preserve many of the buildings, but it hasn't been easy. Most Cubans aren't necessarily historians by nature. It strikes me as surprising, considering exiled Cubans are intrinsic historians. They collect faded photographs, draw maps of Havana neighborhoods from memory, pass down family recipes and traditions as though they're sacrosanct. So much of our history is oral, a byproduct of Castro's unwillingness to allow families to take anything but their memories with them when they left Cuba. Why? I pull out my notebook and pen from my bag, and a soft chuckle escapes his lips. Practicality, I suppose. There's a luxury in historiography most Cubans lack. They're too occupied with surviving in the present to spend their time living in the past. Plus there's the added difficulty of how much the narrative of the past has been shaped for them, and how difficult it is to get honest information out of the regime. It's a real problem because documents that have been around for centuries, marriage records, birth records, are disappearing. We don't have the resources or enough national interest to properly preserve historical documents. Our history disappears a bit more each day, and I fear people won't realize how much we've lost until it's too late. Are there efforts to restore these documents? There are several programs in place with the academic community, but it's a massive undertaking. Hell, getting bread in Cuba can be a massive undertaking. We pass by a bright yellow scooter as Luis navigates into a parking spot. I turn my attention away from Luis to my notebook, jotting down my impression of Old Havana, of the ease with which tourists can get around, for the article I'll eventually write. When all is said and done, my week-long trip to Havana will be condensed into a 2,000-word article to be read on flights and in airports by bleary-eyed travelers. I'm surprised by how busy the streets are, full of tourists and locals alike. The tourists stick out, their shoes new compared to the ones the Cubans wear, cameras in hand, their heads tilted up to take in their surroundings, the beautiful buildings looming around them. At the moment, most of them are speaking languages other than English, but no doubt that will change as more Americans take advantage of the available visa exceptions, and if those exceptions eventually disappear altogether, allowing free American tourist travel. Have you noticed more tourists now that travel restrictions with the United States have eased? With each question, the tension inside me lessens. I can get through a day with him as long as I focus on the sights before us, and not his tanned forearms, the pride in his voice, the sharp intelligence in his words. He's an impressive man, his competence and confidence undeniably seductive. Luis Rodriguez belongs to my grandmother's time rather than mine, and for someone whose life has been steeped in nostalgia, his manner calls to me. He's a throwback to an era when men were gentlemen, and that alone is a powerful lure. Married. He's married, Marisol. We used to get a steady stream of tourism from the rest of the world, but now there's definitely an increase, he answers. The demographics are changing, too. There were Americans before, of course, but more of a trickle, and many were Cuban Americans. It's going to change things when relations open up even more. Yes, it will. He tilts his head, leaning toward me, his voice lowering. The scent of his soap, clean and strong, fills my nostrils. Once again, Cuba is on the precipice of another change, and we're all holding our breaths to see what, if anything, will come of it. Luis does a quick, almost reflexive sweep of the street. His voice lowers again, his head bent, close enough to mine that his breath tickles my skin. He doesn't smell like the expensive cologne I'm used to men wearing. There's something intimate about the scent of soap and man, layers stripped away between us. We live in curious times here, he says, speaking as though we share a secret. Throughout history, we've always been dependent on an outside benefactor. Spain, the United States, the Soviet Union, Venezuela. When the Soviet Union fell and we entered the special period, a bad situation grew worse. Then Chavez came to save us, sending Fidel tens of thousands of barrels of oil each day in an unholy alliance. They were friends, and in that friendship we found ourselves beholden to yet another foreign power. Once Chavez died, we faced uncertainty again. And now we're opening up dialogue with the United States, after nearly 60 years of hatred on both sides, perceived hatred at least, he acknowledges. Castro, Raúl that is, began loosening restrictions on private enterprise in Cuba. Because otherwise who knows what would have become of us. And really that was merely a formality, acknowledging black market businesses as legitimate for the first time. I'm struck by his comments, and even more so by the incontrovertible truth behind them. Signs of Cuban pragmatism are everywhere I look, both in their relations on the world stage and in the daily life most Cubans lead here. The legendary cars like the one we're sitting in now are, of course, eye-catching, with their bright colors and history. But perhaps more impressive is the amount of work that must go into making them run for over 50 years. Luis laughs when I tell him so. Yes, we've learned to become inventors, repurposing everything we can. This car is a luxury. My grandfather was a well-known photographer before he died. The regime liked him, and life was easier. The car was his. For many Cubans, though, something as simple as owning a car is an exercise in all the ways the government can screw you over. Getting gas used to be nearly impossible. So yes, I work hard to preserve the one thing I have. That must be exhausting. He shrugs. It is what it is. In a way, things are better. Having access to the tourists in the Paladar has made a huge difference. I have friends who are doctors and lawyers, but also work in the big hotels on their free time because they make a fortune in tips. We all live under the shadow of the almighty Cuban convertible peso. Why is the Cuban convertible peso so important? I ask, pen poised for his reply. Cubans are paid in Cuban pesos. Everyone makes a set level of pesos every month. But having a private business or working in the tourism industry gives you access to the Cuban convertible peso, which foreigners use here. The convertible peso is pegged to the dollar. The national currency is worth a fraction of it. It's a different world when you're paid in convertible pesos. Cubans make more serving those who come and go, treating the island as a vacation destination, than they do in careers building infrastructure or helping their fellow citizens. And ironically, there is a substantial difference developing in Cuba now between those who have access to the convertible peso and those who do not. I was prepared for the differences between Cuba and the United States, or at least I thought I was. But I truly feel as though I've stepped into another world. My sisters and I grew up with every opportunity available to us, never had to struggle financially, never knew the kind of pressures I see here. There's a different level of poverty in Cuba that suggests that not only is the deck stacked against you, but someone keeps stealing all the cards. And yet you still teach, I say.
I do. The money is important, yes. And believe me, I have fought hard for us to have the restaurant in our family. At the same time, my students are the future of this country. Eventually things will change. They have to.
He says the words with a ferocity that catches me off guard, even as they're muttered under his breath. And now that Fidel is dead? I ask.
I'd like to believe things will change. I hope they will. But who knows? Perhaps the infrastructure is too much, his brother too stubborn, the country too entrenched to really change after his death. He hadn't been running the show for a very long time, even before his death, but he still casts a long shadow. Older Cubans, the ones who lived through his particular brand of hell, are reluctant to refer to him by name for fear of the ramifications of speaking ill of him, for fear of the perception that they are criticizing the regime. That trend is changing little by little, but words have power here. Deadly consequences. I'm not sure if he delivers the last lines as a warning to me or a reminder to himself.
From everything we saw on TV, it looked like people mourned him in Havana, I comment.
Some probably did. Others put on the show they've been participating in for decades now, because it's expected, because it keeps them and their families safe, he replies.
Luis gets out of the car and comes around to the side, opening the door for me. Does the chivalry come to him naturally or through his grandmother's instruction? It's certainly part of his charm. Now that we're out of the privacy of the car, the whispered conversations have ceased, and he's all business. History professor and tour guide. We begin walking, Luis pointing out sights as we go, his shoulder occasionally brushing mine. There's the Capitol building that resembles our own Capitol in the United States. He explains that it's being renovated, scaffolding dominating much of the dome's exterior. A bright red tour bus passes us, kicking up water lying near the curb. Without breaking stride, Luis puts his arm around my waist, guiding me away. His body between mine and the street. It lingers there for a beat before he lets me go. The Hotel Nacional de Cuba is ahead. The design and entryway lined in palm trees, reminding me of the breakers back home. We walk past a row of vintage cars and head inside. Luis walks behind me, silent as I explore. He seems uncomfortable here, his hands shoved into his pockets, his head bent, his eyes downcast, and hiding whatever emotions linger in his gaze. The contrast between the bisected home he shares with his wife, mother, and grandmother, and the tourist domain is stark. 30 minutes pass. We explore the lush gardens, the public rooms, the infamous cafe bar. And then we leave the hotel behind us, in search of the next landmark. We walk by the Museum of the Revolution, the old Bacardi building. I'm more interested in my grandmother's Havana, the sites that formed her love of the city.
but I mark my impressions of the other places for the article. My grandmother's ashes in my bag, weighing heavily on my mind. Havana is a beautiful city shrouded in sadness, yet the remarkable thing is that it's almost as if the people didn't get the memo. They laugh, and there's a jubilant quality to the air. The frenetic pace I'm used to is replaced by an ebullient atmosphere that gives the impression that life is a big party. The Cubans probably have the least to laugh about compared to everyone around them, but they laugh the loudest. We continue walking, Luis pointing out more sights and answering my questions with thoughtful precision. It's impossible to walk these streets and not feel a measure of pride as a Cuban for the beauty that is our capital city. The Great Theater of Havana is stunning architecturally. The Cathedral of Havana is equally so. I hesitate at the church's entrance, watching the tourists file in.
"Do you want to see inside?" Luis asks.
"Do you mind?" He smiles indulgently, glancing over his shoulder, and gently guiding me out of the path of a group of tourists.
"Not at all."
I grab a scarf from my bag, covering my shoulders as we enter the church. Beautiful chandeliers punctuate the interior, the landscape peppered with elegant statues, sculpted and carved to exquisite detail. My grandmother and her siblings were baptized here. My great-grandparents married at this very altar. I imagine my grandmother here as a young girl, sitting in the pews beside her sisters, Beatriz whispering and gossiping to Isabel as the priest says Mass. The sensation of standing in the spot where she once stood, sitting in the wooden pews where she once sat, brings a tear to my eye. And another. This is a piece of my family's history I didn't expect to have returned to me. I don't realize I'm crying until Luis silently hands me an ivory square handkerchief, his expression somber. My breath hitches and I stare down at the fabric in my hands, anything to distract myself from his searching gaze. His initials are embroidered on one corner of the handkerchief, the fabric slightly yellowed with age. I rub my fingers over the letters there, a smile playing at my lips. It seems somehow fitting that a historian would carry a handkerchief, and I have no doubt his grandmother painstakingly embroidered his initials. "Thank you," I whisper.
Despite the Catholic Church's difficult relationship with Castro, his attempts to wholly eradicate religion from the country, there are a few Cubans sitting in the pews praying, their heads bent, rosaries in hand. Tourists mill around us. I recognize two men who were at the Hotel Nacional earlier. Clearly, these are the popular spots to see in Havana. I make a few notes about the church on my pad. I turn away from Luis, lingering over the artwork, exploring the side chapels, attempting to soak in every inch of the beautiful building. I've never been particularly religious, but the ambiance adds an air of solemnity to our surroundings. Luis trails behind me, leaving a few paces between us, and the few times I glance back at him, his gaze is fixed on me and not our surroundings.
"What's it like to be Catholic in Cuba?" I whisper to Luis once he's caught up to me, his earlier warning about curbing my words fresh in my mind. His gaze sweeps across the church before returning back to me.
"Nearly as difficult as it is to be Cuban in Cuba," he replies, his tone dry. We walk around for a few more minutes, and I pay the extra fee for us to climb the bell tower, the city spread before us. I look out past the terracotta-tiled roofs that appear as though they would simply crack off with a strong gust of wind.
"Are hurricanes bad here?" I ask.
Growing up in South Florida, I am intimately familiar with the havoc storms can wreak.
"It can be hell," he answers. "Often the buildings are in such a state of disrepair that even relatively mild weather can prove a problem." He keeps his voice low again, closing the distance between us. Even here, surrounded by tourists, it's clear he's afraid to speak his mind. Across the water there's La Cabaña, the infamous prison Che Guevara ran after the revolution. The sight of it sends a chill down my spine when I think about the blood shed there, the lives lost. There's a violence to our history that gets lost somewhere in the telling, buried beneath the beautiful scenery,
the deceptively blue sea and sky, the palm trees swaying placidly in the breeze. It's the sound of firing squads that echo in the wind. They've built shops there now, a restaurant, Luis murmurs, his body tucked away from the tourist, his mouth hidden in the curve of my neck. You can gawk at the world's largest cigar in the site where we bled. There's something so ironically vicious about that. Luis stands patiently beside me as I take pictures of the landscape. I've blocked out the other tourists, but he seems faintly amused by the conversations around us. His English is quite good given his ability to understand the British family arguing over whether they're going to return to their hotel or continue sightseeing. Once I've finished snapping photos, we leave the church and meander through the streets, drifting from one landmark to the next. I stop occasionally to take more pictures, filling the pad with additional observations. Some journalists use electronics, but there's something about the rhythm of putting pen to paper that I can't resist. It adds to the spirit of my surroundings. I imagine Hemingway scribbling in old notebooks, the ink staining his fingers as he sips a mojito in the late Havana sun. Havana lends itself to the romantic and idyllic, even as the evidence to the contrary is everywhere I look. Perhaps that's the double-edged sword to being Cuban. We're both pragmatic realists and consummate dreamers. We walk on, the sun growing brighter, the heat increasing. My dress sticks to my skin, the air pregnant with humidity. It's like being back in Florida again. There are other landmarks to explore. The father of Cuban independence, José Martí, is everywhere, on statues and streets. We all claim him as ours, revolutionaries and exiles alike. Are you getting hungry for lunch? Luis asks as we walk down the street. Yeah, I am. We walk a bit further and leave old Havana behind, the scenery changing to more run-down buildings, less antique charm. Dogs roam the sidewalk, others lounging in the available shade. The pedestrians on the sidewalk shift from European tourists to locals. I stand out here, my clothes setting me apart from those on the street. The unmistakable sense that I belong more with the tourists than I do in this Cuban neighborhood, a visitor in the country that should feel like home. We buy tamales from a stand in Vedado. The cornmeal is warm and moist, perfect paired with the sweet soda I buy from the vendor as well. I stumble on a crack in the sidewalk, and Luis is there at once, his hold on me steady and reassuring. Out of the corner of my eye, I spot the same two men from earlier at the church and the Hotel Nacional. Except now that they're removed from the tourist spaces, it's clear that they, like Luis, belong to this part of the city. Are you okay? His hand wraps around my arm, his breath along my skin. I nod, pulling away, shutting down the urge to lean into him, to relax my body against his. That's the thing about desire. It creeps up on you at the most inconvenient times, too often with the most inconvenient people. We continue walking, and this time I pay more attention to my surroundings. The vendors in this part of the city aren't selling touristy items, but basic things Cubans can use in their everyday lives. Fruits and vegetables, shoes, books. A few doors down, a queue of Cubans line up outside a building that looks similar to a convenience store. Dogs hanging around here, too. They're getting their food rations, Luis answers when I ask about the line. On average, your ration book entitles you to rice, sugar, cooking oil, eggs, pasta, and coffee every month. Protein, typically chicken, every 10 days. A bread roll every day. Every few months you get salt. Young children and pregnant women receive milk. It's never enough, he adds, his voice low once again. They run out all the time. Milk? Forget it. You have to go all over town, standing in lines to get all your rations. It's a job in and of itself, literally. I am filled with the deepest amount of shame as I think of all the food I've taken for granted throughout my life. The Michelin-starred restaurants where I've dined. Some of the wealthier families hire someone to get their rations for them, Luis explains. And you used to not be able to buy certain items unless you had the tourist currency. The Cuban convertible peso,
He nods.
See why the paraderes and businesses like the casas particulares, where people transform their homes into hotels, are so important? Things are slowly changing, and previously banned items are now available to Cubans who pay in regular pesos, but they're so expensive hardly anyone can afford them. While our guests in the paladar dine on ropa vieja, many Cubans have never even tasted beef. Supply is an issue considering we import the vast majority of our food. So where do people go to get the food they need when the government stores aren't enough? The black market. What's the penalty if you're caught? It depends on the scale of involvement in the black market, but it's not unheard of for people to be sentenced to more than 15 years in prison. You can serve a greater sentence for killing a cow than a person in Cuba.
Jesus.
Hasn't been to Cuba in a very long time, Luis replies. Silence falls between us. I'm at a loss for words. The life he describes is a far cry from mine, and I feel awkward around him, as though the things I could contribute to the conversation are frivolous and shallow in comparison. I spent so much time listening to my family's stories about the revolution, and yet I failed to consider how bad things were for those who remained. My family focused on the revolution and its effect on them, but less attention was paid to the current state of things. Food rations and fear make up Luis's Cuba, and my version of it is something else entirely, one that slips through my grasp more and more with each step I take down the Havana streets. I came here hoping to understand more about where I came from, but now I feel more lost than ever. We walk toward a section Luis tells me is called La Rampa. Crowds of people stand around with their phones out, their gazes riveted by the mobile devices. Wi-Fi zone, Luis explains. One of a few in the city. We pass a cinema in what used to be known as the Havana Hilton, Fidel Castro's one-time headquarters and home. You get more of a feel for how everyday Cubans live here, Luis says. Old Havana is great, but it caters to tourists. There's a different ambiance here. Across the street he points out Copelia, the ice cream shop Fidel made famous after the revolution. It's always busy, he answers when I comment on the size of the line. Cubans do lines better than anyone. Lines for bread, lines for beans. There's good-natured humor in his voice. I guess if you can't laugh about it, then you just might cry. You probably don't do much waiting, he adds. And I can't tell if he's speaking generally about life or my family specifically. Either way, he isn't wrong. Our fortunes haven't changed much since we left Cuba. Castro temporarily derailed them, but it wasn't long before my great-grandfather had rebuilt his empire. What would our life have been like if we'd stayed? Would I be here on the sidewalk, standing in line for food? Was staying even an option, considering Castro's regime targeted my family? Do you ever wonder what things would have been like if your family had left? I ask Luis. When I was younger, I thought about it more than I do now. What's the point? I wouldn't be the person I am if I didn't grow up here, in this time, in this place. Even though we share the same heritage, as hard as I search for commonalities between us, as much as I want to belong here, the differences are glaring. I am Cuban, and yet I am not. I don't know where I fit here, in the land of my grandparents, attempting to recreate a Cuba that no longer exists in reality. Perhaps we're the dreamers in all of this. The hopeful ones. Dreaming of a Cuba we cannot see with our eyes, that we cannot touch, whose taste lingers on our palates with the tang of memory. The exiles are the historians, the memory keepers of a lost Cuba, one that's nearly forgotten. Chapter 11. The day winds down with too much speed, the air turning cooler, the sun sinking lower and lower in the sky. I'm eager to return to the house and ask Anna the questions that have been running through my mind, but I'm also reluctant for the day to end. Luis is good company, and if I'm not mistaken, he's enjoying himself too. With each hour that passes, he seems more relaxed, his tongue loosening as he teaches me about Cuba. And then there's the part we don't speak of, the manner in which our bodies shift with each second. The physical distance between us lessening with each breath.
Awareness sparks within me, an electric tingling feeling of anticipation and longing. That infinitesimal pause before lips touch for the first time, the beat when fingers link, the instant when you're unwrapping a present and realize it is exactly what you wanted. Married, Marisol. He's married. We drive down a street in Vedado, the old buildings surrounding us capped in the sky's golden rays.
Why don't we make one more stop? Luis suggests. You can't miss the sunset over the Malecón.
That sounds romantic. It's getting late, I answer. And I'm enjoying myself far more than I should. I'm ashamed of my reaction to him, the ease with which I've allowed myself to be distracted from my purpose here, finding my grandmother's final resting place. I want to talk to Anna, to learn more about my grandmother's mysterious love. And at the same time, I don't want this day to end. I've avoided the topic of his wife all afternoon, and he hasn't brought her up either. But she exists between us regardless. Her body taking up space on the car's bench seat, the disappearing inches between his hand and my leg, his shoulder and mine, the gap between the whisper of my dress floating in the breeze and the clothes that drape his tanned limbs. I slide my palms down the fabric of my dress, attempting to release some of the nervous energy that runs from my wrist to fingertip. The water peeks out between buildings, the sky already in transition, and I want to sit on the mighty seawall and get the full effect.
Are you sure?
He asks.
We could swing by for a minute. It's not something you want to miss.
I hesitate, torn between the need to play it safe and the desire to indulge. Just for a moment. There's a boundary between us I absolutely will not cross, no matter what. So what's the harm? Maybe just a minute. Luis nods as though either answer I could have given him would have been satisfactory, but I don't miss the smile tugging at the corner of his mouth, or the warmth that enters his eyes. My stomach clenches. He finds a spot to park the car, coming around the side and opening the door for me. The city vibrates with energy now that the temperature has cooled. People hanging out their windows, lounging on balconies and stoops, calling to one another with good-natured teasing. It's raucous and beautiful, and more than anything, I want to belong here, want this city to become a part of me. It takes us a while to cross the street. Luis gestures at drivers tugging me along as we maneuver through the lanes. He stops when a car comes too close, his body between me and the vehicle, shielding me from the oncoming traffic. The vintage cars drive past, the smell of diesel pungent, the roar of their engines in my ears. In this snapshot of Cuba, I see it through my grandmother's eyes, as she remembered it. At night, the Malecón comes alive. But there are cracks in the image, and not just the ones on the path beneath our feet, the gaps freckling the surface. It's easy to spot the tourists. The locals approach them selling cigars, scantily clad women offering something more. It's a stark reminder that this isn't the country my grandmother remembered, that underneath the historic beauty, there's a sense of desperation. No one approaches us. Perhaps they identify Luis as one of their own. This piece of Havana isn't for the tourists. Rather, we're allowed to share their part of the city, however briefly. This is the beating heart of Havana. Teenagers congregate, laughing and joking around. Young couples stroll hand in hand, their walk punctuated by the occasional kiss. Ice cream vendors pepper the landscape. Farther afield, people fish off the seawall. One day, will they tear down the beautiful old buildings and replace them with high-rise condos that sell for hundreds of dollars a square foot, touting this unparalleled view of the Caribbean? We walk down the promenade, our shoulders almost touching. Luis adjusts his stride for the difference in our height. I barely reach his chin. Do you think it will change in the future? I ask him. If money begins pouring in and the tourists come.
Perhaps. We've learned not to look toward the future too much. It's hard to get excited about building things when someone comes behind you and knocks them down again.
That sounds frustrating, I say, knowing my words aren't enough. He laughs, the sound devoid of humor, to say the least. How long has the Malecón been a part of Havana? I ask, changing tack. They began construction in 1901. I can easily see Luis standing before a classroom of students as he gives me a rundown of the site's history. Can equally imagine his students hanging on his every word. I pull out my notebook and write down a few of the facts he shares with me. Once he's finished speaking, he gestures toward an open space.
Do you want to sit for a moment?
I nod, following him to the edge. He offers me his hand and I take it, my fingers curling around his as I sit down on the seawall, my legs hanging over the ocean. He releases me and lowers himself next to me.
During the day, it's hot, Luis says. You still see people here, but it changes at night. The temperature cools, the sun recedes. It becomes magic, I finish for him, embarrassed by the emotion in my voice.
This is the gua my grandmother described to me.
Yes.
A man strums a guitar in the background. Luis's hand is on the stone inches away, his naked fingers long and tapered, his nails neatly trimmed, his skin a few shades darker than mine. Those inches feel like a mile. Or 90. His head is bent, his gaze not on the sunset, on those beautiful colors, but on our hands and the distance between them. My fingers itch to move forward. My palm is rooted to the stone.
Is there anyone waiting for you back in the United States?
He asks, his voice low. My heart skips and sputters in my chest. It takes a moment for me to speak, and when I do, the word is a little more than a whisper, drowned out by the crash of sea against rock, a group of musicians playing several yards away, cars whizzing past us. But I know he hears me. His hand moves, an inch, two. His pinky rests against mine, his finger grazing mine. It stays there. His response to my answer. No. We don't speak the rest of the evening. From the time we depart the Malecón to the moment Luis leaves me in the entryway of his family's house with a nod, taking the stairs two at a time before he disappears entirely. I stare after him. Is he going to see his wife? More than a little ashamed by my behavior this afternoon. Nothing happened, but the desire was there. Simmering below the surface. There will be no more tours of Havana with Luis. I walk up the stairs and into the guest room, setting my bag on the bed and removing the container with my grandmother's ashes. I place the makeshift urn on the desk before heading off in search of Ana. I find her in a tiny room off the kitchen area. Seated on a couch in what was once probably a small salon in their grand home and now serves as their only living area. The silk furnishing is faded and worn, the fabric sagging and stretched thin in places, but it's obvious it used to be a beautiful piece. Ana smiles as I walk into the room, gesturing to the empty chair across from her.
You've returned. Did Luis show you Havana? Did you have a good time? I'm sorry I wasn't able to go with you, but today is my day for the market, and honestly, the girls never get the good vegetables, she says with a smile. I assume the girls are Luis's mother and his wife. Tonight we have ropa vieja, she adds.
The mention of the dish reminds me of Luis's discussion earlier about the rationing system in Cuba and the challenges most Cubans face. The meal, which translates to old clothes, is one of my favorites. Shredded beef seasoned with peppers and garlic in a stew-like creation that's served over rice. It was wonderful to see the city, I say. Rattling off the list of places we went, wondering if my face is as flushed as I feel. Ana pours me a cafecito from a set on the tray in front of us. She takes a sip of the coffee, and I follow her lead.
I'm so glad you enjoyed yourself. Now, you aren't here to talk about Havana, are you? You opened the box.
I nod.
You have questions?
Yes. Did you know my grandmother was involved with a man here in Cuba? His letters to her were in the box she buried in her backyard. I think he was a revolutionary. Did you know about him?
I didn't know him. Elisa and I were best friends. We told each other everything, but with him it was different. She talked about him a bit, not by name, but the occasional allusion.
She sighs. Those were dangerous times. But Thetha's punishments were merciless. She likely kept her young man a secret to protect both him and the people she loved. I knew she was in trouble, though, and I knew she was in pain. Anna takes another sip of her coffee. What do you want to know?
Everything. What was his name? What happened between them? Was he really involved with Castro? Is he still here in Cuba?
I'll tell you what I know, because she wanted you to have the box, the letters. She wanted you to know this part of her life.
Then why didn't she just tell me?
I don't understand why she never mentioned him in all of the stories she told me about Cuba. Perhaps it hurt her to talk about him. And there was probably shame, too. Those were polarizing times for the Cuban people. Families were torn apart by political disagreements, including Elisa's. My great-uncle was disowned for opposing Batista, wasn't he? Even now, my great-uncle is a sore spot for my family.
He was.
Your great-grandfather was one of Batista's biggest backers.
Whether out of expediency or true fervor, I don't know.
I was too young to worry about those things. But much of the country did not share those views. There were real problems in Cuba before the revolution. There was no justice, no chance of democracy. Those of us who lived behind the gates of the grand estates in Miramar knew little of suffering. We were surrounded by people who looked like us, who had access to education, who possessed wealth. Our lives were parties and decadence, the violence somewhere in the background. But for many Cubans, those were horrible times. A movement began within the country. It started, strangely enough, among children of the elites. Don't forget, Fidel himself was the son of a wealthy farmer. The very people who enjoyed Batista's largesse discovered their children sympathized with the revolutionaries. Their sons fought for democracy and change and were willing to spill Cuban blood to achieve it. It would be easy to say that the revolution divided us along the lines of poor and wealthy, but it's not that simple. It's not shocking to me that Elisa fell in love with such a man, but Emilio Perez would never have accepted his daughter with a revolutionary. And it would have killed your great-grandmother. She was descended from Spanish royalty, and she expected her daughters to conduct themselves accordingly.
And my grandmother never told you his name?
No. He was from Havana, but I'm not sure what part of the city.
Was he her age?
He sounded older from the tone of his letters, more worldly, certainly.
A bit older, I think.
Most of the men involved with Fidel's movement were in their 20s or early 30s. Boys, really.
What else did she tell you about him?
One day we were supposed to have lunch and go shopping at El Encanto. This was a couple of months before everything fell apart. Late October or early November. I went to the house to see Elisa.
Chapter 12 Elisa, November 1958. This time he's gone for longer than ever before, and the letters arrive sporadically, delivered through subterfuge and random messengers in his absence, read in the privacy of my room when I can sneak away from everyone and escape into his words. The fighting is intensifying. The tide is turning. Batista is on the defense, his forces and resolve weakening. Hopefully this will be over soon and he will be gone. Hopefully I will be back in Havana and we will be together again. I write him nearly every day. My letters tame compared to the stories he tells me. Of sleeping beneath the stars, existing on meager rations. He gives me enough detail that I feel as though I am there with him. There's poetry in his letters, in the manner in which he describes his actions, his fidelity to Cuba, and in his words for me. I think of you often. I try to imagine you going through your day, laughing with your sisters. I use my imagination to paint a picture of your life. It keeps me company when we're marching, waiting for things to happen. I never realized war would be so much waiting. I imagine what our future will look like, where we will live, how we will live together. Attempt to envision what my life will look like when we defeat Batista. I think I would like to go back to practicing law, perhaps become a judge one day. I can no longer fathom a future without you. I write back to him, the act of committing my pen to paper giving me courage to share all that is in my heart. I want a future with you, too. I scour my father's library for José Martí's writing, for the men Pablo admires, Locke, Montesquieu, Rousseau. The books are faithful companions as I wait for him. The days between his letters turn into a week, two, and pass by as I spend time with my sisters, shopping with Anna. Alejandro is gone as well, and I can't help but fear that unseen forces are operating within the country, weaving disorder, and two men I care about, deeply, are involved. The presidential election is held on November 1st, and Batista's candidate for president, Agüero, wins under mysterious circumstances. Murmurs ripple through the country, suggesting Batista rigged the vote in his favor. We waited and waited for elections, years, years of promises, years of hope for democracy, years of Batista, and it was all a foregone conclusion. Agüero will be Batista's puppet. The hope many held in their hearts is now reduced to tatters. After nearly a decade of Batista, we are now to have more of his rule, in one form or another. We are fractured between those who are ambivalent to this outcome and those who mourn it. No one seems genuinely happy about Batista. He is not a man who garners great loyalty, except perhaps within his most inner circle. But there is a sort of muted relief that envelops my parents. Our house has become an uncomfortable place, everyone walking on eggshells. The servants smile, but there's an edge to it now. A simmering anger lingering behind the flash of white teeth. Our nanny, Magda, is a buffer between the family and the rest of the staff. Both parent by love and employee in our parents' eyes. She's the glue that keeps us together now that the family feels more fractured than ever. Isabel is consumed with Alberto, each day pulling further and further away. Maria is occupied with her games and toys, cocooned in an imaginary world where Cuba isn't cannibalizing itself. And Beatriz and Alejandro, they always had secrets as twins, but now I fear those secrets run far deeper and more insidious. I've already lost one sibling to this madness. How can I lose another? Magda walks beside me and Anna as we drift through the store, our gazes lingering on the glittering jewelry ensconced behind glass cases. It seems incredibly indulgent to go shopping in times like these. But without these amusements to pass the time, the days grow stagnant, the waiting and wondering and tension unbearable. "What do you think about this necklace?" Anna asks, pointing out a pretty set of pearls on display. "More your style than mine, but pretty. They'd look nice with your new yellow dress." She smiles. "They would, wouldn't they?" She lingers over them while Magda and I drift to the next set of cases, the next display of exquisite jewelry. "I wish Beatriz would have come with us," Magda whispers to me. "Me too." "What did she say when you invited her?" Magda asks. "That she already had plans." I didn't ask what they were. At the moment, it hardly seems in my best interest to inquire, considering how much we've all been sneaking about lately. Plans. Magda's expression is grim. She needs to spend less time up to no good, and more time trying to find a husband. I can't help but grin. You sound like my mother. Magda and my mother are strange allies in the house. Their attitude toward me and my sisters might be different, but they work in concert. Magda, a gentler, more affectionate version of our mother. "Your mother knows what she's about, and for as smart as she is, Beatriz can be incredibly foolish." "Headstrong," I say, feeling the need to defend my sister. Her expression softens. "Yes, headstrong. And a bit stubborn, too." My lips twitch. Beatriz is undeniably stubborn. I reach out and squeeze Magda's hand, the familiarity of her touch a comfort in these tumultuous times. Anna joins us, and all talk of Beatrice ceases. Magda, too, shares our mother's devotion to protecting the integrity of the Perez name. I wander off, half-heartedly looking at jewelry while Anna buys the pearls.
Elisa!
I turn at the sound of my name, at the faint pressure against my elbow. My brother is suddenly in front of me, and for a moment, seeing him here in a store we accompanied our mother to when we were younger, it feels as though we have gone back in time, to when things were simpler and we weren't divided by ideology and war. Alejandro looks better than he did outside our home the day he saw me with Pablo, but he's still unkempt, his appearance so different from the urbane brother I remember.
"What are you doing here? How did you find me?"
I whisper, my gaze darting around the store. Magda and Anna are thankfully preoccupied with the pearl purchase. His expression is grim.
"I was waiting for you outside the house. I saw you leave with Magda and followed you.
I need to talk to you."
He pulls me into a corner so Magda and Anna can't see us.
"I heard a rumor the other day. They say Batista has arrested some rebels. Fidel's men."
My heart turns over in my chest.
"No, not Pablo.
He's alive. They're holding him in Havana, in La Cabaña."
My legs tremble. Batista's prison is notorious.
"They say he's being questioned on Fidel's movements."
Alejandro's voice lowers.
"Did you know he was Fidel's eyes and ears in the city?"
"I suspect it." That Pablo is on Batista's radar is a death sentence. Despite the ideological differences between us, Alejandro's still my big brother. And in this, I can't help but search for reassurance.
"What will happen to him?" I ask.
Alejandro's silence is answer enough, even if it's not the one I wanted.
"They'll kill him, won't they?"
He nods. That's the thing about families. They always tell you the truth, even when you'd almost prefer the lie.
"What can I do?"
I ask. I'm not sure how much more helplessness I can stand. Alejandro's gaze narrows.
"Do you care about him?"
The words are clogged in my throat behind a morass of fear and guilt.
"I do."
"Then there's one person who might be able to help."
If helplessness is my Scylla, then the solution is most definitely Charybdis. I hover on the threshold to my father's study. I've never done this before, never used my family's influence in such a blatant, flagrant attempt to secure what I want. I've been in a daze since my brother came to see me, panic flooding my veins. My father is seated behind his enormous desk, papers spread before him. I wince at the sight of the newspaper shoved into a corner. Has he already read about the arrests? How will I convince him to throw his weight behind freeing Pablo? He looks up from his desk, and his eyes widen in surprise. This study is my father's domain, and we tiptoe around it, reluctant to bother him when he's working, when it's clear he has little time for our frivolities. Let him think this is a whim, nothing more. Don't let him see my heart is breaking.
Elisa, what can I do for you?
I have a favor to ask, I answer, nausea rolling around in my stomach. A brief look of annoyance crosses his face, but he waves me in.
Come in.
I close the door behind me, crossing the Persian rug, and take a seat in one of the antique chairs opposite his desk. The corsair, captured in yet another painting, stares down at me from his place of prominence behind my father. This iteration of him is more dour than the one in the upstairs hallway. They say the corsair was once threatened with the gallows. Perhaps this portrait was captured around that time. I now have an uncomfortable familiarity with men who look as though they are on the precipice of hanging by one means or another. My father leans back in his chair, studying me over his black-rimmed reading glasses.
What do you need?
My father is an imposing man in both his public and private life. He's never been cruel, but he's not the sort of man who invites confidences.
Still, I've always believed him to be fair. He must know Batista's actions are wrong. I've never viewed him as a blind supporter, but rather as a man willing to do anything to survive. A father and husband willing to sacrifice his integrity to protect his family. I take a deep breath. I have a friend. He's in La Cabaña. Can you secure his release? I have the novel experience of seeing true shock on my father's face. He gapes at me, his mouth hanging open like a fish. If I could have avoided this, if there were anyone else I could ask, I would have. But my brother is right. In this, I need someone with the kind of power our father wields.
What did you just say?
He asks, a knife-like edge to his voice. There is a delicate balance to this. The art of giving away enough to convince him to intervene, but not so much that he will lock me away in a convent somewhere. My friend is being held in the city. No trial, no charges. It's a struggle, but I fight to keep any emotion from my voice, to stick to a dry recitation of the facts. My father will not be swayed by sentiment, and in this case I fear any affection I show for Pablo will condemn him rather than save him. He's innocent, I add hastily. The lie slips out with far too much ease. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. He's a lawyer, a good man, from a good family. I swallow. Please. My father blinks, momentarily in a stupor.
You want me to do what?
They will kill him. They're probably already torturing him. I thought perhaps... A tremor racks my body. I thought you could use some of your connections to see if he could be released.
How can you ask me this?
My father sputters. I reach now for some thread of courage I didn't know I possessed. The same courage I admire in those around me. My brother, Pablo, Beatriz. Because it's the right thing to do. Because he's a good man who has been put in an untenable position. He hasn't done anything wrong. You know what's happening in Cuba. How paranoid Batista is. You raised us to know right from wrong. What Batista is doing is wrong.
Not you, too.
A wealth of sorrow fills my father's voice. My breath hitches. He's silent for far too long. When he does finally speak, I am surprised by the fear flickering in his eyes, stamped all over his face. We never talk of Alejandro, but now I see a glimpse of the weight of my father's loss. My parents have always loomed larger than life. My mother so glamorous and elegant, my father exuding power and authority. He looks smaller sitting behind his desk, as though recent events have overwhelmed and diminished him. It is a terrifying thing to see fear in your parents' eyes.
What is your role in this, Elisa? Are you involved with the rebels? Is this your brother's doing?
He whispers the question as though the walls have ears. Perhaps they do these days in Havana. No, not at all. I force a smile, praying he believes me. He's just a friend. Really, more of a friend of a friend. Nothing more. I have nothing to do with the rebels.
Is this some boyfriend of yours?
His face reddens, his expression turning thunderous. No, really, just a friend. Someone who was caught up in something. My voice shakes as I tell my father his name, as I shatter the secret I've kept for so long. He has friends from the university, and their activities have drawn Batista's notice. He hasn't done anything wrong. My father studies me quietly, and when I think all hope is lost, he sighs.
You need to be careful. I am not oblivious to the goings-on in this house. Your sister's relationship with that boy, Alberto. Or Beatriz.
His voice trails off.
Batista is under a great deal of pressure right now. He had hoped the election would satisfy the people, but it has not.
because the people know it was little more than a sham, I mutter. My father's gaze sharpens, his hand hitting